News. I'm Gregory Berg. WGTD News Time is 10 after 8. The morning show is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today, beginning with a newly recorded interview with the co-authors of an intriguing new book for children called What Jewish Looks Like. In part two of today's program, we're going to remember baseball superstar Pete Rose, who died the day before yesterday. You'll hear my conversation with the author of a new biography about Pete Rose called Charlie Hustle. Part three will feature a strange yet true story from the world of the carnival. Here's part one. And I am excited for the next few minutes to be able to speak with the co-authors of a lovely and enlightening new book called What Jewish Looks Like. The co-authors, Liz Kleinrock and Carolyn Kusin Pritchard, have both heard that tired phrase far too often, you don't look Jewish. And just what is tied up in that phrase prompted the two of them to want to put this book together that introduces all of us, whether of the Jewish faith or not, to the wide diversity that, in fact, is the Jewish community, both here and all around the world. And along the way, we meet some distinguished Jewish heroes and heroines in various walks of life who have made a powerful difference for the better in the world. The book is published by Harper, and although intended clearly for young readers, is actually a book that a whole lot of us could learn a whole lot from. And I'm excited to be able to speak with both of its co-authors, Lynn Kleinrock and Carolyn Kusin Pritchard. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having us.
I would love to hear from each of you about your own perspective in terms of what it has been like to move through the world as someone of the Jewish tradition, particularly as young people, and the way in which you wished way back when that a book like this perhaps had existed. Whoever wants to begin.
Sure. Thanks, Greg. This is Liz. So I am Korean, adopted, and Jewish. And so growing up, I did not look like really anybody in my synagogue, in my Hebrew school, at the Jewish summer camp that I went to, and was constantly faced with this comment and assumption of like, oh, you don't look Jewish. And then sometimes that was followed by a question of, oh, well, are you mixed? Did you convert? Did you marry somebody Jewish? Like as I got older, and constantly feeling like I had to be on the defensive and try to prove my belonging within the Jewish community, which was exhausting and frankly, like harmful for a really long period of time, especially as a kid, when you feel kind of just like an outsider. And so I really wanted to write this book to dispel this idea that all Jewish people look a certain way, all come from the exact same place, practice Judaism in the same way, because as we say in the book, there are 15 million Jewish people in the world, so that means that there are 15 million different ways to be Jewish.
Carolyn, how about you?
Well, I, unlike Liz, grew up kind of looking like the way most people perceive Jews to look. So I have an Ashkenazi background, I'm white presenting. I grew up in a synagogue where folks looked a lot like me. And so I think I was so unaware of the beauty and diversity and depth of the Jewish community. And so I realized as part of that, I must be upholding a ton of stereotypes and harm without knowing it because I had such a limited understanding of our people. And so when Liz initially came to me with this beautiful idea, I thought, what an opportunity to be able to create something that I only wish we had as kids, to help crack open people's idea of what it even means to be Jewish to begin with, let alone what visibly people look like who are Jewish.
One of the things I loved in the book's introduction is a line that refers to this book springing out of the long-standing tradition of Jewish curiosity. Could you tell us more about that and the way in which you feel like this book is a lovely and beneficial reflection of that?
Sure, yeah, this is Caroline. That is the curiosity and asking questions, I feel like, is at the root of so much of my Jewish identity, and I believe I can speak for Liz as well. And it's something that we wanted with a book that attempts to do so much. You know, in this one middle grade book, we're trying to share 36 individual stories from around the world, from different times and places, with different identities and backgrounds. And so we knew we couldn't do it perfectly or holistically. And we also knew that, especially with kids, when you hand them everything all at once, that is never a satisfying feeling. So we thought, how can we invite readers into an experience of getting enough of a taste to really have some language and understanding, but also be left with so many more questions that they get to explore on their own. So, you know, we opened the book with a bunch of big questions that I think are really topical now and always, like, what does it mean to be an ethno-religion, or are all Jews white, and kind of ground us in a common understanding. And then when we dive into each of these stories, we try and make them as dynamic as possible with pull-out quotes and information about their backgrounds and what were some of the most interesting pieces of their lives. And the illustrator, Iris Gottlieb, just brings this to life in such a gorgeous, powerful way. You can't help but want more when you hold this book in your hand.
Right. I love that spread with the big questions. And I say this as someone who happens to be Lutheran, who I've certainly had friends and colleagues of the Jewish faith and know something of this tradition in life, but I have, and I think a lot of us have, a whole lot to learn, and your book is sort of a lovely gateway to that. I especially appreciate the way in which you take a little bit of time in these big questions to talk about the Jewish diaspora, and right after that is essentially a map of the world, where at a glance we realize that that your community stretches far and wide to nearly every corner of the globe. And I'm sure that is also right at the heart of what you want all readers to understand.
Exactly.
Tell us about then the process of assembling this impressive list of heroes and heroines, and I don't remember now just how many there are, but there are dozens of them, and each of them kind of given their own spread and spanning all kinds of different eras and occupations and so on. Talk us through the process by which you put this part of the book together, and especially just the basic matter of assembling who you wanted to talk about out of a nearly limitless list of possibilities.
Yeah, this is Liz. Thank you for the question. So in our book, we highlight the biographies of 36 Jewish people from history and to today. We could have gone on for much longer or definitely created multiple volumes. Our spreadsheet, as we collected different folks and tried to create this balance of representation, was incredibly extensive. But it was really important for us to zoom out and be able to show the complexity and diversity of the Jewish community worldwide, not just within a particular lens of the United States. And so for us, it was really important to make sure that there was multi-ethnic, multi-racial identity, that when we talk about the concept of diversity, that we are applying this in every sense of the word across all different types of identity markers, in order to ensure that Jewish people of many different backgrounds, different appearances, would hopefully be able to pick this book up and see themselves reflected in one or more of the pages here. In terms of organization of the book, though, we certainly notice that in similar biography collections, oftentimes the lives of the individuals who are featured are sometimes organized chronologically, or sometimes they're organized by their career, profession. And for us, that didn't really feel right. And so instead, we took a look at different Jewish values. So things that, despite the diversity of the community, are still things that unite us and have driven all of the people who are featured in this book through their purpose and their passion and their meaning in life.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Liz Kleinrock and Carolyn Kusin Pritchard, who are the co-authors of a book called What Jewish Looks Like. And after examining and answering a few big questions about the Jewish faith, the Jewish tradition, the Jewish community, they go on then to celebrate the lives of 36 different people who were or are Jewish and have, in one way or another, left a lasting mark on the world. I have to say, I mean, I enjoyed this entire part of the book. I especially enjoyed what you had to say about a Jewish woman by the name of Emma Lazarus in the portion of the book titled Hope. I think my eyes lit up because I had recently done some research into an Irving Berlin musical called Miss Liberty, a lighthearted musical from 1949 that dealt, at least in part, with the Statue of Liberty. And it was only in that research about that musical that I came across this name of Emma Lazarus. And if I had known this name before, I had forgotten it, or her really important contribution to history and especially to the legacy of the Statue of Liberty. And her life is amazing. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about Emma Lazarus and why she is part of your list of heroes and heroines of the Jewish faith?
Yes, I love that you centered on Emma. I love her story as well, especially with us both as writers and her being such a beautiful poet. What we love about Emma's story is that her family, of course, had emigrated here years, you know, was one of actually the original families to come to the United States, or early families. And so she was acutely aware of what that immigration story had meant for her future. And so she bore witness to folks in the 1880s just fleeing these pogroms throughout Russia and in Europe and trying to make a better life here in the United States. And so she was acutely aware of the struggles they faced there and once they arrived, and she fought tirelessly to be a voice to platform them with services and with access to language and whatever she could do. And so she went on, of course, to write, you know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Her words are what's on the Statue of Liberty now, welcoming all those into our country. And so what a powerful story informed by her Jewish family and her Jewish values that she could then go on and fight for others.
I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about one or two other heroes or heroines whose lives are lifted up in your book. Maybe especially a name or two that might not be familiar to many of our listeners.
Oh, I feel like there's so many to choose from.
Right.
It's a good problem to have. This is Liz. One of my favorite people to write about is actually someone who's local to D.C., where Caroline and I both live. His name is Michael Twitty. He's a chef. He's an author. He's a culinary historian. And his book, Kosher Soul, is one of my favorite books, like within the Jewish genre and also without. He has done such incredible research into his Jewish roots, his Jewish culture, and also embracing and combining it with his African-American, and Sephardic identity as well. He's Black, he's gay, he's Jewish, and he really understands that food is something that connects us. It connects us to each other, it connects us to our past and our ancestry. And so not only has he written about this, but he's also, he actually founded something called the Southern Discomfort Tour, which takes people to places in the South that were important to his own ancestors during times of enslavement in the United States. And I think that his story is also just such a really beautiful example of how intersectionality exists in the Jewish community. So I love him. Another local person from D.C. who passed away fairly recently, Judith Heumann, who was an amazing disability rights advocate. She actually belonged to the synagogue where my family and I attend, and her story is also just incredible.
Yes. And I love what you mentioned about people that we may not recognize, because there are definitely names that are bigger celebrities that folks may go like, what? They're Jewish? I didn't know Sammy Davis Jr. or Sue Bird or Tracy Ellis Ross was Jewish. And we want them to have that kind of reaction and that enthusiasm and excitement. But certainly being able to spotlight folks like Michael. Another person who I love learning about her story is Raquel Montoya Lewis. She is someone who has, she's a Native American, she's indigenous, and she's also Jewish. And so she talks beautifully about this idea of resilience running through her veins, this tenacity she gets from all sides of her identity, and how she channels that through her work as a justice in Washington State. She just has an incredible story, and it's so clearly fueled and powered by her identity.
Right. And we can go from there to read about actress Marley Matlin, or a well-known figure like Harvey Milk, and on and on the list goes. And it is an astonishing array of accomplishment that we read and explore in this book. Most of the time when people write books, they have, at least in a general way, somebody in mind, somebody that they imagine holding this book in their hands and reading it and benefiting from it. Did you have anybody in particular in mind as you shaped this book?
Well,
great question.
This is Liz again, and I imagine Jewish kids who had really similar experiences that I did growing up, of having maybe a collection of Jewish books or media and just never seeing people who look like themselves or their stories or their families represented there. And perhaps even for the first time being able to see that they belong, that they are part of this really beautiful tapestry of Jewish history and culture from around the world to today. And even if other folks in their community might not see it, that they will understand and hold that deep into their core and know that it's something that no one can ever take away from them.
That's so beautiful, Liz, and I love your answer, and I feel particularly grateful. I have four Samoan Jewish babies, so little Polynesian Jewish babies that I hope share the sentiment that Liz just communicated, and getting to see them pore over these pages and feel connected at such early ages has been a real gift for me as a mom. I also imagine, beyond exactly what Liz just shared, I imagine non-Jewish readers, kids that maybe subconsciously are already forming potentially harmful stereotypes or understandings of what it means to be Jewish, and being able to see a book like this that can disrupt some of those, some of that thinking early on, and help open up their idea and understanding of what it means to look and to be Jewish.
The book again is What Jewish Looks Like, co-written by Liz Kleinrock and Carolyn Hewson Pritchard, illustrations by Iris Gottlieb. The book published by a Harper, a division of HarperCollins. Thank you so much for giving the world this wonderful book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. Very best wishes to you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part two of today's program, we're going to be remembering the charismatic and controversial baseball superstar, Pete Rose, who passed away on Monday at the age of 83 from heart disease. Earlier this year, I had the pleasure of recording an interview with Keith O'Brien, responsible for a new biography of Pete Rose called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, published by Pantheon Books. You have done such a brilliant job of bringing this extraordinary figure of Pete Rose vividly to life. At one point, very early in the book, you describe Pete Rose as the most ordinary, extraordinary athlete in the history of American sports. Explain what you mean by that intriguing turn of phrase.
Well, I that is how I think about Pete Rose. You know, he, frankly, you know, was ordinary in many ways. He had ordinary talent. He had ordinary athleticism for the entirety of his childhood. And I mean, all the way through high school, he was never the best baseball player on his own team. And you know, despite all these things, you know, he gets a chance to play minor league baseball. And he gets that chance because he has, you know, one torrid stretch in the spring of 1960 in essentially a semi-pro league in Dayton, Ohio. And he's got a connection. His uncle Buddy is friends with the farm director of the Cincinnati Reds. So almost as a favor, you know, he gets an offer to go to Geneva, New York to play for the Geneva Redlegs. And this is the lowest of the low of minor league baseball. It's a rung of baseball that's so low it doesn't even exist anymore. And you know, he manages to do well there and move his way up. And all of these things just seem incredibly unlikely. In fact, you know, as I went back and looked at it, I think, frankly, it's almost miraculous that Pete Rose ever became Pete Rose.
Mm. And one thing I learned among many things I learned from your book is that this famous nickname he was given of Charlie Hustle was not meant as a compliment. It was attached to him by a couple of his rivals who were, in a sense, making fun of that sort of scrappy side of him. But it's a perfect nickname, isn't it?
It's a great nickname. Really becomes his persona. You know, Charlie Hustle is the kind of guy who will sprint down to first base on a walk, the kind of guy who will get into a fight at second base trying to break up a double play, the kind of guy who will, you know, run into a catcher at home plate and break his shoulder in a meaningless exhibition game. That's who Charlie Hustle is. And it is, I think, endlessly interesting that the nickname is bestowed upon him almost as sarcasm. You know, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford are watching him play in a spring training game in 1963, and they find it absurd how hard he is playing. But, you know, it would be easy, you know, say, coming from Mickey Mantle or Whitey Ford to make fun of Pete Rose. I mean, those guys were like the golden gods of baseball, you know, imbued with so much talent. And Pete Rose knew that he had to play hard. He had to work hard in order to make it.
Right. I mean, to be in this world at all, let alone to succeed. One of the things I think I most deeply appreciate about this book is that someone else with other priorities would have probably focused nearly all of his time and attention on the downfall of Pete Rose, the disintegration of his baseball career. And you don't do that. I mean, we are told that story in almost breathtaking detail, but you are just as careful to tell us the story about his glory days. I'm reminded of a TV interview with figure skater Tanya Harding that for once focused on her first triple axle and asking about that in great detail. And as she's recounting it, she stops and starts to cry at one point and said, "I'm sorry, nobody ever asks me about this anymore." I mean, of course, her whole life was swallowed up in her scandal. And in some ways, you know, Pete Rose is maybe to some extent a similar sort of story. And you seem to be so anxious for us not to just think about the disaster that engulfed Pete Rose and brought his career down in flames, but you want us to also remember his extraordinary glory as a player before all the rest of that happened.
I'm so glad you mentioned. I agree with that 100%. You know, Pete Rose in some ways has lived for so long and made so many mistakes off the field that we have forgotten who he once was or who he really is. And again, whether you like him or not, whether you defend him or not, Pete Rose was an American icon. He was one of our greatest icons in the second half of the 20th century. And my premise from the start of this project was that we only care about someone's fall, about someone's mistakes, about someone's foibles or implosion in the case of Pete Rose, because we ever cared about them in the first place, you know? And so I wanted to, you know, essentially in this narrative, take us back to this time and place when Pete Rose wasn't the caricature of an old gambler that we know today. he was young and he had dreams, and America saw in him, you know, its own dream and its own story.
Sure.
And so, you know, my goal with the narrative was to bring him essentially to the mountaintop, because Pete Rose will get to the mountaintop of American life.
Right.
And give folks the view from that mountaintop, because the view was amazing. And then we can watch him tumble and fall off that mountain, because he will, in large part because of his own decisions, his own choices, and his own addiction.
Right. Speaking of mountaintops, you choose to begin the book, your introduction, in September 1985. Briefly explain why this is such a critical moment in his life and career, and why you chose to, in effect, begin your book there.
Only two men in the history of baseball have ever amassed 4,000 total hits. Ty Cobb, and then in 1984, he was joined by Pete Rose. In the history of baseball, two guys have gotten 4,000. And in September 1985, Pete Rose is on the cusp of passing Ty Cobb and claiming the all-time hit record. And, you know, baseball has waned in recent decades as a cultural touchstone, but it was so critical to American culture in 1985. And, you know, this moment in Cincinnati on this night when Pete will pass Ty Cobb is carried live on national television. Networks break into regularly scheduled programming, tell viewers that Pete Rose has just passed Ty Cobb. And if you were alive and watching, you know exactly where you were that night. And 50,000 people were at Riverfront Stadium, where the game took place, in Cincinnati. And when he, you know, safely rounds first and comes back to the bag with a clean single to left center field, the crowd at Riverfront showers him with a standing ovation that will last for 7 minutes. And you know, that's notable, of course. All of those things are notable. But the most notable thing to me is this. You know, as the crowd continues to cheer unabated, you know, Pete Rose, you know, finally can't take it anymore. He becomes emotional. He breaks down and he cries. And it is significant to me because it was the first time anyone had ever seen him do that. And by the way, it was the last time. We haven't seen that kind of emotion from Pete Rose since 1985.
Wow. We're speaking with Keith O'Brien about his brand new book, amazing book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Your book is not only about Pete Rose, but about the game of baseball. And you say in the introduction to the book that the world and the world of Major League Baseball had changed dramatically in the quarter century that Pete Rose had played professional baseball. That is kind of leading up to the start of the fall. What would be a couple of the most significant changes that occurred in baseball during his career? And what I'm really interested in is the changes that really matter in this particular story. That is, how had baseball changed in a way that, in a sense, helped contribute to Pete Rose's self-destruction?
Well, it changed in a couple of important ways. And the first is all about money. You know, in 1963, when Pete is a rookie, almost every ball player had to have some kind of off-season job. You know, guys could not live on a baseball salary. The free agency that comes in the 1970s, which I believe is deserved by players, nevertheless fundamentally alters the game in ways we're still wrestling with today. You know, fans begin to begrudge the fact that players are so highly paid. The owners are even wealthier. And by 1989, when Pete Rose gets in trouble for gambling, and when the rumors of his gambling on baseball first reach the front office of Major League Baseball in New York, the league has just signed its very first billion-dollar television contract. And Peter Uberoff, the outgoing commissioner at the time, is very proud of it. He holds a press conference in New York, and he tells everybody that billion with a B. And the money in the game and the corporatization of baseball really fundamentally changes it. Baseball had once been not just a sport where the players didn't make that much money. They were just also a little unpolished, a little rough around the edges. In the 1960s and 70s, many of our beloved stars said and did things that they could never get away with today. In this new world that was coming, Pete Rose is still behaving the same way he always had. He still believes he can do anything, but he can't. And for the misdeeds now, he's going to pay a terrible price.
One of the choices you make, and it is such a good choice, and it's one of the most important aspects of the book and fascinating aspects of the book, is that you talk not only about Pete Rose himself, but about some of the people who were in his close orbit, who assisted him in all kinds of ways, and in effect, in some cases, were sort of accessories to the crime, not sort of. and the story of how they were kind of drawn into his orbit, what attracted them to Pete Rose, and then some of the difficult choices they ultimately had to make. That's an especially interesting facet of all this. We don't have a lot of time, I'm afraid, but maybe you could just choose a couple of the most critical figures and just talk about what was kind of most interesting or compelling about them as you told this story.
Yeah, the figure that comes to mind for me is Tommy Giosa. Tommy Giosa was one of these men in Pete's inner circle. He was one of three men that I interviewed who placed Pete Rose's bets on baseball. And, in past, works about Pete and in many newspaper and magazine articles written in the 1980s and 90s, Tommy is often described with words that I think are not just insulting but inaccurate. They would, call him a hangers-on or a thug or whatever, and I don't see it like that at all. Tommy, like many people, was enamored by Pete, and I will say Pete has a charisma about him. He had it then, he still has it now, and when you are getting Pete's warmth and attention, it does make you feel something. And so Tommy is almost trapped by Pete's gravitational pull. Even when Tommy knows he should maybe stop hanging out with Pete Rose, he should maybe leave Cincinnati, he should maybe stop doing Pete's bidding, he can't. And for these choices, Tommy Giosa, will pay an awful price. Hmm. He will ultimately spend more than 2 years in federal prison, in part because Tommy refused to cooperate with investigators in 1989 when they wanted to know what Pete was doing with gamblers.
He was such a loyal friend in so many ways. It sounds like one of the chief reasons that Pete Rose got into his most serious trouble, that is when his gambling escapades expanded beyond other sports to include his own sport of professional baseball, that escalation and just the amount of gambling that he was doing, that is part of what got him in trouble. And also that as he sort of escalated, he also sort of climbed into a different level of the gambling world and in a sense was maybe dealing with less friendly characters. Briefly, can you talk about that aspect of Pete Rose's ultimate self-destruction?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I tried to do with the book was really sort of chart how Pete unraveled, and it really begins in the early 1970s when he at least by that point, if not sooner, is betting with a bookie on the west side of Cincinnati. Pete Rose's part of town, the place where Pete was born and raised. And, in the early parts of his gambling career, if you will, Pete was, often placing his bets with friendly bookies, let's say, guys who, would let him carry a debt, guys who weren't even going to rat him out when and if they got arrested. And by the way, some of them did in the early 1970s. And they don't turn on Pete when they easily could have then. But by the 1980s, that's changed too. You know, Pete is no longer placing bets with bookies that he has known his whole life. He's placing bets with bookies who are total strangers. And some of these men, you know, have their own shady ties. You know, some of these men are on the edge of organized crime. And so, you know, again, Pete is still behaving like he had for years and is blissfully unaware that the world has changed and that the men he's now gambling with don't really care about Pete Rose. And that's going to matter because one of these bookies will ultimately turn on Pete, and he will tell Major League Baseball everything it wants to know.
Looks like it's our last question, which is Pete Rose steadfastly maintained his innocence when it came to betting on baseball for years and years and years. It's not until 2004 or 2005, I think, that he finally admits to that. You got to actually interview Pete Rose. I wonder, in your conversations, did you get a sense of what prompted him to finally make this admission that, yes, indeed, he had bet on professional baseballs and even on games involving his own team? Why did he admit
that? His admission comes way too late. Why does he admit it in 2004? You know, Pete says that it was time to finally tell the truth. I think there's some ulterior motives there as well. You know, he was hoping that by finally telling the truth, you know, that he would essentially be forgiven and maybe possibly reinstated as an eligible player. Obviously, in 2004, when Pete is now 63 years old, he's not going to be playing baseball. But by being an eligible player, he would then be eligible to be voted on for the Hall of Fame. So, you know, I think that was a key reason why. But it's too late for Pete. And the way he does it is ham-handed and sort of considered, even by some of his friends, to be craven. You know, he doesn't go on, say, the Oprah Winfrey show or your show and apologize and break down and cry. You know, he writes a memoir and you know, receives a very large advance from a publisher to do so. Even in his attempt to apologize and to reckon with what he has done, he somehow makes it worse.
Keith O'Brien is the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, published by Pantheon Books. Pete Rose passed away on Monday, the 30th of September, at the age of 83. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 3 of today's program comes from the Morning Show archives. Well, if you want to be taken on a wild ride in several senses of the word, then you should be reading a book called Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist, written by Peter Fenton. And this is a book which takes us back to the early 1960s, to rural Michigan, and to Peter Fenton, who seems like a relatively normal young man until he meets up with a fellow student named Jackie, who ushers him into an incredible world which gets called at one point sort of the underworld of the carnival. And it is an incredible journey, and it changes him in all kinds of different ways. And the result is a truly entertaining and also pretty thought-provoking and poignant memoir, again called Eyeing the Flash, The Education of a Carnival Con Artist. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And we have Peter Fenton with us for a few minutes to talk about this remarkable story and book. Peter Fenton, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Greg, thanks for having me.
You know, it's interesting. You've actually written a couple of books before this.
Yes.
It kind of amazes me that one would live out as extraordinary a story as this and not be just chomping at the bit to write it before anything else. Did you wait to write this book for any particular reason?
Yes, I think I had to process the whole experience because it was quite different than I expected to live my life working on the carnival business. I was just a straight-ahead student and never expected to wind up running around on the carnival circuit. So I it took me a long time to kind of figure out what attitude I had about it.
So you've been kind of coming to terms with this over the years.
Right. I mean, I did things that I guess I could say I feel guilty about now, although I didn't think about them in that way at all when I was actually doing them as a teenager, which was basically involved bilking people out of money when they walked down the midway and played the games.
You were ushered into this world by a fellow student by the name of Jackie.
Yes.
And your first encounter with him is basically in the halls of your school and then kind of back in the corner of the cafeteria. Just give our listeners a little bit of a sense of that first encounter with this remarkable young man.
Yeah, well, he was really an unusual guy. We were both about 15 or 16 at the time, but he was sort of like had the patter of a Vegas comic. Even though he was that age, he was quite tall, 6 feet, and very sure of himself. And, he took me under his wing, and I really didn't know why at the time, but it turned out that it was because I was good with numbers. And so he brought me onto into his business. First it was working a casino that he had in the basement of his parents' home. And so I helped figure out the odds that would be to our advantage, that sort of thing. And we made a good deal of money from our fellow high school students because they didn't know anything. Not that we were the greatest experts in the world of odds, but our fellow students didn't know a thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, of course, a little bit of this even involved some adults. You weren't just victimizing fellow students.
Right. Later on, then, when I graduated the Carnival Midway, I was about 17 at the time, and I would be playing with people two or three times my age, some of them from relatively sophisticated backgrounds. One guy was a federal a prosecutor. Other person was a major of an Air Force base up in Upper Michigan, and I would win $200 or $300 from people of that order. Again, not thinking of it, I was a good student of the carnival con, just as I had been a good student in high school. I didn't have a particular I guess I had a con man's heart, and I didn't know it. At least I did for a few years.
This book, of course, is about more than that life which you were living. It's also about the family situation which you came out of and which your friend Jackie came out of. And
right.
His situation, of course, especially horrific, I think, but yours not an easy one either.
Right. It is a memoir, and so it has that. It starts out with our family backgrounds. Mine, I had the typical dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father and which made me a real withdrawn sort of kid, which is why I was waiting for somebody, I guess, like Jackie to come along and help me get out of myself. He came from a very dysfunctional background as well. His parents were both carnies, and they treated him and everybody else sort of like a mark or a sucker. And so it was. He was constantly battling against them to, kind of stand on his own. Now, the interesting thing is we wound up eventually going in opposite directions. I kind of gravitated to the carnival, and he wanted to go into the legitimate life to get away from it. So he, after the carnival years, went to business school, University of Michigan, and now is a professor in the business school at Wayne State University in Detroit.
And I'm pretty sure you have yet to meet as adults.
We haven't met, but after the book came out, he actually called up. There was a review of it in the New York Times. He found out about it, and he gave me a call, and he said, you know, and I was, of course, tense about how he would take it, but he said, hey, it was great, and you got it, 95% there in terms of what I believe is the way it happened. So that was kind of gratifying. His actual name is Edward King, and he teaches small business development at Wayne State University. So it was sort of an appropriate background. I don't know how many people know that he started out as a carny and now is telling them how to run their Baskin Robbins store, that sort of thing.
The other thing that we, of course, really learned through this book is not just your own story, but we learn a lot about the world of the carnival, and in particular, the extraordinary hierarchy, albeit maybe a somewhat informal hierarchy, which exists. Just tell our listeners briefly about that and the experience of climbing through the ranks as you did.
Right. When you walk down the midway, there are all these all the games, and you really don't know that there is this hierarchy of carnival agent, as they're called. You start out as a what they call a hanky pank operator, and that's the games like a duck pond or hitting a balloon with a dart, that sort of thing, and that's generally run by raw beginners like myself when I first started out, or guys who've kind of been broken down by the harsh carny system. The next step up is called the alibi store, and those are games where the carnival huckster is able to has an alibi why the customer didn't win. Those are generally games of skill, like throwing the baseball and knocking the cat off the shelf or the basketball through the hoop, that sort of thing. So even though the game is rigged or gaffed, as the saying goes, the alibi agent says, well, you threw the ball too fast, or you threw it too slow, that sort of thing. There's always an excuse. And those are pretty rough because you're physically rough because you're up against people who have balls in their hand or bowling pins, that sort of thing, depending on the game. And they're standing face to, you're standing face to face with them and taking money from them. The next, the highest level, which is one I reached when I was only 17, was it's called a flat store, and it's difficult to describe on the radio, but it's basically, it's kind of like a roulette wheel type game, that sort of thing, and just involves counting numbers, and what the agent or carnival con does is just keep one step ahead of the customer in the counting, and so that they can manipulate the course of the game to make it appear that you're going to win very quickly, very early on, and then just keep you just on the precipice of winning, but never going all the way over the rest of the game, and that's where the person starts to lose. So there is that hierarchy, and they even dress differently. The hanky-panks, the guys in the bottom, you know, they'll maybe, you know, they'll dress in blue jeans, that sort of thing, and they'll sleep under the trailer at night if they haven't had a good week. And the carny and the flatties, the flat store agents at the top of the ladder, well, they'll have a hotel room and wear sharkskin pants, wander under the midway, maybe in the middle of the afternoon, after having had a steak dinner at the local Sizzler restaurant or something like that. There's definitely a pecking order.
That's just one of the fascinating things we learn about life in the carnival in your book called Eyeing the Flash, published by Simon & Schuster, the author Peter Fenton. Peter Fenton, I much enjoyed this book and talking with you about it today on the Morning
Wonderful.
Show. Best wishes.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Tomorrow on the Morning Show, the editor of a new book called Why Books Still Matter. And on Friday, we preview Carthage College's production of the energetic musical Xanadu. Our weather forecast today calls for sunny skies and a high of 70 degrees, clear overnight with a low of 51. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 76 degrees. It looks like sunshine will remain with us for the weekend. No rain in the forecast until early next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music